Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Professor Ronald Ridley, honorary in historical and philosophical studies at the University of Melbourne. This is episode LXXXI, Livy. Livy was a historian writing during the Augustan Age of Rome, and he wrote one of the empire's most famous works, an extensive and exhaustive history, spanning 142 books. Of those, we have the first quarter, and they've influenced every work on Rome that has been written since. Here's Ronald Ridley.
This is the 2000th anniversary of Livy's death. That is, if we accept Jerome's figures, dates, that he was born in 59, Caesar's first consulship, and died in AD 17.
Whose dates were those, sorry?
From St. Jerome, the 4th century, who had a chronology with all kinds of correspondences.
Yeah. And if there's somebody who doesn't know who Livy is, how would you describe Livy?
Well, for some of us, this might be going a bit far for many, it would be for many people, the greatest of the Roman historians, simply on the grounds that he produced the greatest historical undertaking of all antiquity. There's no Greek or other Roman historian who comes near what he did, spending a lifetime, his whole life from his adult years, about the age of, say, 30, until his death, writing what ended up being 142 books of history. Mm. Everyone else pales by comparison, Tacitus and even Thucydides or Herodotus.
That was something that he spent his entire life
entire
doing.
Life.
Yeah.
Yes.
And did he get up to contemporary times for him?
Oh, yes. But the interesting thing is the really fascinating puzzle, which I'm not sure anyone has got a proper answer to, is that he ended his history in 9 with the death of Drusus. And that's book 142. Got clear evidence that work, in the early part at least, is designed in groups of 5 and 10 books. Mm. So you'd expect him to have 140 books or 150 books,
yeah,
or 145. Why 142? He seems to have had the chance to go on further but stopped at that point. And there's a big argument then about whether that's just a chance or whether this is a really significant date. In other words, whether he thought that Drusus, the brother of Tiberius, who was killed on campaign to Germany, whether he thought that his death really was a serious turning point, a good place to stop. He didn't want to go on, perhaps, because, you know, as Walter Raleigh said, if the historian gets too close to contemporary events, the horse of history can turn around and kick him in the teeth. You know, it is dangerous for historians in certain regimes to go on too far. You know, Tacitus held back and so on.
Sure. So he, I don't want to comment about Tiberius's reign.
Well, sure. He's into Tiberius. You're dead right.
Yeah.
Yes. Augustus has been dead for 3 years, AD 14, and he dies in 17.
Mm.
A colleague was suggesting to me that maybe this Drusus connection is serious. Maybe Livy and Drusus knew each other and had some connection.
That's a very maybe.
Well, yes, but it's very exciting if we could possibly do anything with it.
Mm. So what is the background of Livy? Why was he the sort of person to bury himself in writing history?
That's a very, very good question. I should have said something else about his importance, that he was preceded by dozens of earlier historians of the Republic, but his achievement was so great that all of their work has been lost. So he totally swamped all the preceding writers. Now, why he got onto history? Well, he's a fascinating, somewhat enigmatic character. We don't know a great deal about his private life. We only know him through his history. But he was born in Patavium, up in northern Italy, Padova, near Venice, in 59. We know that he must have been quite well off. We don't hear of him having to earn his living in any way.
Mm.
He devoted himself to the gentlemanly pursuits of the time of grammar and rhetoric and so on, which was a Bachelor of Arts degree, I suppose, in our modern parlance. You know, humanities, essentially. Seems to have early on supported himself by teaching those things. But then suddenly, in the 30s, it seems, much argument about when he began to think about his history and when he actually began to write it. But now increasingly, people used to say, oh, perhaps he started after the Augustan settlement in the early 20s.
Mm.
But now increasingly, people are saying, no, that's too late. He wouldn't have had time to do what he did. So maybe even during the civil wars in the late 30s, when the outcome of it was anything but clear, You know, not until 31 that Antony's defeated. He begins to see a great theme. What's going on? Without even knowing if that's correct, of course, how it's all going to end up. Because he's essentially imbued with, I'm sure of this, and so are most other sensible people, he's imbued with Republican principles. And he perhaps sees the end of the Republican era coming, and he wants to record that.
Okay.
Mm. Yeah. He sees a great, great theme. How is it that Rome began as nothing, reached the point of ruling the world, and then went through, from the late second century, a tremendous upheaval and collapse with appalling civil wars in which he was still living?
By this point, he's in Rome when he's writing, isn't
he? And he came to Rome at some time, we don't know, but there's a big argument about that, of course. Some people think he spent most of his life in Patavium, writing away, secreted in a study or something. I think that's most unlikely. He's a provincial, he's a municipal man. He's got tremendous problems in dealing with the intricacies of Roman history because he's not part of the ruling class, like all aristocracies. I mean, if you were writing a history of the British aristocracy, you or I as colonials wouldn't know what we were doing. We'd make so many mistakes and blunders. Well, Livy must have been aware he had to be in Rome to get his hands on the stuff that would allow him to sort out all that history.
Sure. But unlike other Roman historians, I'm thinking of Tacitus and Dio here, he's not a senator. He can't embed himself and get those records and get...
Well, that's
as easy access to that kind of information, can
he? I don't know. That's a question we can't answer about accessibility. What his main sources would be the earlier published annalists. Because he's been accused by people who are just out to get him. There's a very strong anti-Livian gang who've held the field. I think it's people like Mommsen in the mid-19th century. And then that runs through until, essentially, James Luce's famous book on Livy in the 1970s, who started to say, wait a minute, people are just refusing to read what he tells us. So, his sources. All the earlier annalists, who, of course, were published and in his age accessible. And we know, despite what some moderns say, we know he read, for example, Fabius Pictor, the earliest of the annalists. If only we had Fabius Pictor, we would just love him. He read Cato, old Cato.
Mm.
He read Calpurnius Piso, the consul of 133, who was the most controversial of all the Roman analysts, the most individual, the man who was likely to say, you've all got it wrong, I've got the right answer. He did that time and time again. Livy's detractors say he didn't ever read Fabius Pictor, he got it at third or fourth hand. I mean, for heaven's sake. Livy's not stupid. He knows perfectly well in his sources. He keeps saying about Fabius Pictor, he is the earliest authority. Mm. He knows that you go back to see the earliest Roman historian there and see what people are saying at the beginning of the historical tradition. He's not silly.
So just before we start talking about his works, I want to get a sense of his life just a little bit in Rome. How closely was he associated with the imperial power?
That's a major question. Most people simply say... Although he wasn't in sympathy with the regime, he was on good terms with people like Augustus. Now, the main evidence for that is a totally misunderstood source. It's Tacitus' Annals, Book 4, Chapter 34. This is the defense speech by the historian Cornelius Cossus, who was on trial for treason in AD 25, one of the treason trials under Tiberius. He'd been hauled up for praising Brutus and Cassius, for example. In his defense, he said that Livy was known to be a Pompeian, so Augustus called him. Now, that may be true, but what is the nature of the source? It's amazing. This is in Book 4 of Tacitus' Annals, and Tacitus is writing this sometime after AD 100. So a century after Livy. And it is a speech. Now, normally, alarm bells ring. As soon as an ancient historian is writing a speech, everyone says, oh, that's probably made up.
Mm.
Because we've got this idea that historians invented speeches. Well, speeches were an integral part of all ancient historiography. I think no one would buy a book unless it had speeches in it. I mean, people love that as a way of vivifying history, of dramatizing and so on. So here is Tacitus, writing a century after Livy, writing the defense speech of this historian Cremutius Cordus in AD 25. Did Tacitus have a source for this speech, or did he make it up? We don't know the answer. But according to Tacitus. Tacitus thought that Cremutius Cordus would have said that Livy was a friend of Augustus, even though they were on opposite sides of the political spectrum. And that this goes back then, this is AD 25, this is what Cremutius Cordus thought about Livy. So at how many removes are we? It's not a flat historical statement. Livy was a Pompeian and Augustus made a joke about it, but they still were on good terms. It may be true, but we've got so many ifs about this source, you can't just treat it as an ordinary statement of fact. May be true, because everything from Livy's history indicates he was a Republican, and so in the last part of the civil wars, wouldn't he be a Pompeian? And then, of course, there's the famous quote, just to back that up, the famous quote by Seneca the Elder, saying that Livy said that he wasn't sure whether it was a good idea that Caesar was ever born.
That's quite a statement to hang
around. That's quite a statement, yeah, isn't it? That's quite a statement. So it gives us some idea of Livy's political boldness.
Yes. The other one that readily comes to mind is the quote from Suetonius, which may seem to indicate that Livy's perspective changed over time, maybe, because by the time the young Claudius comes along, he recommends to Claudius that he should be writing history. If I remember correctly, Claudius did write a work on the Etruscans that we've since lost.
If only we had Claudius' historical works.
Yeah.
Yes. His history of the Etruscans, we'd give our right arm for that. Because he was married to an Etruscan princess.
Was he really?
Yes, so he had connections with the Etruscan. Almost undoubtedly read Etruscan, you know, he could understand Etruscan.
Yeah, but if that was a correct influence, then that means that he does have a close association.
Well, okay, that's another source, and it's very important, so let's just see exactly what it says. It's Suetonius' Life of Claudius, chapter 41, and it says precisely that he began, that is Claudius, began to write a history in his youth, Hortante Tito Livio. The way this has been taken ahead by moderns saying, oh, he was Claudius' tutor, the text says nothing of the kind.
If we can now talk about Livy as a writer and a historian, why was he writing this work of history?
As I said to you, people used to think he began writing after the end of the civil wars. I mean, that would be an obvious stock-taking time. It's time to say, well, what happened? Why have we reached this point? The world has changed completely. We have the victor in the civil wars now as unchallengeable head of the Roman world, although he's, you know, a man in his 30s. It's the most incredible outcome of the civil wars. No one would have foreseen that, I think. I mean, if you'd said at the beginning, you know, who's going to win, everyone would have put their money on Antony. But he made those tragic mistakes of getting hooked up with Cleopatra, which really undermined his war effort. But the trouble is that we have strong evidence that Livy had finished Book 4 by 28.
Okay.
So now you've got to imagine he's going to write this huge history, which obviously starts at the foundation of Rome and is going to come down probably to his own time. I mean, how much time would you need to start thinking about what the work would look like, to plan it? And when you'd started to have an idea of what was going to be, then to say, well, how am I going to do this? What was Livy's working method? We don't know, but we can only guess. Did he just plan each book singly? I don't think that's very likely. You know, in other words, just read up what he thought, select two or three previous writers and have a look at those for book one, write book one, and then choose two or three writers for book two, read those, make notes, write book two. I don't think that. You know, he must have thought about it from early times. Then the preparations. I say, what preparation does he need? And then he actually has to start writing the books. And he's finished Book 4 by 28. So that, I think, is primarily why you have to push back his first planning of it to something like at least the late 30s. Some people go as early as 35. You know, that's the modern thinking, and I think it's in the right direction, rather than coming down to 29, 28, 27, something like that, after the first settlement.
So you said that his books were divided up. So
Well, he's clear about that.
10, 5 books.
Well, he writes a new preface, for example, in Book 6.
Yeah.
You know, Book 1 to 5 go to the conquest of Rome by the Gauls, the Gallic Sack. And then he begins with Book 6, Chapter 1, with a new preface saying, well, from now on, it's a different game. The Gauls destroyed, he's maybe exaggerating, but he says the Gauls destroyed most of the historical records. We don't believe that so much now. But it's a new beginning, and history becomes a little more easy from here on to write and so on. And then, of course, clearly, you know, the Hannibalic War is books 21 to 30. That's clear as a bell, isn't it? And then you've got 31 to 45, which make three groups of five, which bring you down to the end of the wars in Greece and so on. I mean, we can see this pattern of fives and tens and even 15s.
Yeah. Well, what you just outlined then is vaguely mostly what we have, isn't it?
Oh, well, of course, we can't talk about what we don't have.
Yes.
We've got exactly one quarter of the history.
And mostly the early stuff.
And so there's an interesting question people sometimes raise. People make jokes about they would exchange the books we have for, say, a similar number of books towards the end of the history.
Oh,
we'd
really?
Like to see. Yes. I mean, some people have said that. Yeah. They're just being contrary, I think. But, 35 books to see what he said about the civil wars. From the Gracchi on, for example, or something like that.
Why do you think that what we've got is what we've got? I hesitate to say it's because Hannibal crossing the Alps is the exciting bit, so that's the bit that's been preserved.
That's a very good observation, mind you. The most logical answer you can start with is that we rely for the books we have essentially on Petrarch and his work in the 14th century. He was the man who realized that Livy's books were in danger and scoured the monasteries and libraries of Europe and managed to put together books 1 to 10 and 20 to 40. Had he not acted then, God knows how little we would have.
Mm.
And then mostly 40, 45 have been put together bits and pieces since then. Why that survived? Well, perhaps we could start off with a bigger question, why the rest was lost? It's not answering that question directly, but suffice to say, most people are sure that because Livy was so vast, something like double text of Gibbon, 142 books, it was just too big for most people to cope with. I mean, he tricked himself, so to speak, by writing on such a vast scale, and most private libraries couldn't cope with it. And so, from fairly early on in the piece, there started to be these wretched summarizers who produce these epitomai and periokes, they're called. And when you've got summaries where you can read in half a page a book, you know, instead of 30 or 40 or 50 or even 60 chapters, then, of course, the epitome, the summary survives. And, of course, there was the problem of the writing material when it was written on vellum, as it must have been in copies that survived. That was too valuable a writing material. It's not paper that you just throw away. It's stuff that you reuse, hence the palimpsest. You rub with a pumice the vellum skin and can write over it. The writing materials were too valuable to be lost. But why the first quarter, essentially? Well, the earliest period of Rome was fascinating to everyone. And then, as you just said, the Hannibalic War. But we don't really know why those books as such. No, we can't answer that. I think it's accident. I would go for that if I had to make a choice.
If you were to make a choice, would you have the Livy that we have, or would you have later books?
Yes, because we've got so many other historians on the later period.
True.
And this is the most difficult period that he's writing about. The earlier history is the most difficult. So I think that's my choice.
So was Livy a celebrity in Roman time as a contemporary?
Yes, yes. There's a famous story. There's a famous story reported by Pliny. At some unspecified date, damn it. I mean, why doesn't Pliny? Pliny's such a wonderful historian. Pliny the Elder doesn't say. But at some point when he was famous, a citizen came from Gades, which is Cadiz, which is about as far as you can get. I mean,
Spain, the bottom
of Spain. Mm. It could only come from Britain to be further away in the west. Came to Rome just to set eyes on Livy, saw Livy, and turned around and went home. That's a wonderful story.
That sounds like a story, though.
Yes, okay. But you can even say it's just a story.
Yes.
But, of course, such stories reflect a feeling about Livy's fame, that someone would do that.
Mm.
We know from a very, very late source that he gave public readings of his history.
Wow.
Which was a common thing to do in Rome.
So that would have been something to see.
Yes. Yes, it would have been.
And was he well quoted amongst other historians and writers?
Yes.
How much influence did he have on those that came after?
Those later historians who wrote poetry on the Hannibalic War and so on. Mm. I'm not an expert on Silver Age Latin. Dio in the 3rd century, writing his history of Rome, of which so little survives, but the central part on the Augustan period does, he is thought to have used Livy for his account of the civil wars, for example. And Augustine was using him as one of his main sources for early Roman history in the City of God in the 5th century. Mm. So it goes on.
I was wondering if you could tell me about why he differs from a modern historian or what he has in common with a modern historian. Would you consider him a historian or a writer or a poet?
Well, the first thing to say is, I suppose, to that, it would be unfair to expect Livy to be doing the same kinds of things as historians are doing now 2,000 years later.
Of course.
But, yeah. Well, you say of course, but a whole lot of people don't understand that. They go for him, like a ton of bricks, about all his failings, which are, of course, true. I mean, he didn't hold any public office, so he wasn't acquainted with the inner workings. Like all the previous historians of Rome, the annalists, had been office holders, most of them consulars, like Cato and Calpurnius Piso and so on. Fabius Pictor, one of the members of one of the oldest families of Rome, who was himself certainly a priest and so on, went to Delphi to consult the oracle in the Hannibalic War. So they're all at the center of power. Livy has no inner knowledge of how politics works at Rome in that sense. Now, this is a fascinating point. People say, and it shows how mad people can be when they want to get at someone, that he clearly never served in an army because his battle accounts are so poor.
Yes, I read that claim.
You would read that claim.
Yeah.
Well, as if every man who's ever fought in a war, in a battle, becomes a brilliant military historian.
Mm.
There's one thing military historians know. How difficult it is to get a rational account from any soldier who's fought in a battle, simply because any soldier in a battle can see only what's happening in his immediate vicinity.
Mm.
So they all are important sources that you might consult, of course, and try to put together to get an overall picture. But the idea that Livy, if he'd ever fought in a legion, would have been an excellent military historian. I mean, Polybius is an excellent military historian, but he was a general. That's a different story. So Livy has all these problems.
But by the same account, though, you'd be discounting, for example, Tacitus's Germania because he never visited Germania.
Yes, quite
when,
so.
When he wrote that. And
quite so.
He wrote it just based on accounts of talking to people.
Quite so.
But he never saw the place himself, so...
But we don't go into that line on Tacitus much, do we? You see, that's what I'm saying to you.
Yeah.
You've hit the nail on the head. The big question is about Livy's basic working method as an historian. Well, I wrote about that for Athenaeum some years ago. I'm very pleased that it was published in such a wonderful journal. Livy's the critical historian, which, of course, to most people is just an oxymoron. I mean, Livy the critical historian, don't be stupid. But there are more than... I just dealt with the first decade, first 10 books, because that's the most difficult. And I found more than 100 places in the first 10 books where Livy alerts the reader to problems with his sources.
Mm.
100 places where he fronts up and says... We've got a problem here. You know, it's a contradiction in sources or it's an uncertainty and so on. So he's always fully aware of what's going on. And most of the time, he sorts it out in a completely rational way. Sometimes, of course, he's defeated. And the interesting point about that is, and they jeer at him and say, look, you know, what a mess he's left. The simple way to test that is, have a look at all the great modern historians on these same points where he's uncertain. Have they got it sorted out? No.
Mm.
They leave it in the same uncertainty as Livy left it. In other words, we're not able to do better 2,000 years later. Time and time again, we leave it where he left it. But so many times he does sort it out. He does it by logic, he does it by common sense, or he does it by saying Fabius Pictor is the earliest source. Or Polybius famously said, a source not to be despised. Well, of course, that's the understatement of the century because Polybius was his main source from book 30 to 45. And in the early history, his solution, where there's confusion, is a healthy skepticism. You know, all these stories about the early period of Rome and the period of the kings and so on, he'll just say, look, this is just a fabula. This is just pharma. This is just a story. This is just the story that's told. This strange credibility, like the story about, say, Horatius defending the bridge and falling fully armed into the Tiber and swimming safely to the other side, Livy says, well, that's a story really that's more just, you know, a good story rather than something you'd believe.
He's right, yeah.
Yes.
So what do you think Livy's impact has been right up until the modern age? How has he influenced how modern historians work, how we think about Rome? What do you think his place is now?
Well, he's still the dominant historian for early Rome. As I said, his account in antiquity superseded all his predecessors, which is a great shame. We wish he had them. And his reputation, Dante called him Livy who never makes a mistake. Funny exaggeration. The answer to your question is simply look at any modern account of Rome. And who's the main authority the modern historian has to grapple with at every turn?
Mm.
It's Livy. He's still there. He's still the main authority. Make of him what you will. You can't avoid him. I mean, we can supplement him by other odds and ends, but he is the main continuous account down to the 290s, BC in the first 10 books.
And why is he somebody that you...
Me, personally.
Personally, why do you like to keep him around?
Well, essentially because As a young man doing my postgrad work, I, of course, was imbued with critical, you know, young people get carried away with hypercriticism and so on. They're so excited to find problems with sources and show how clever they are in detecting errors and contradictions and the like. But as you get older, I think Livy is appreciated more as you get older. You begin to realize what his achievement was. There's a man of great sensitivity, a man who is essentially kindly in his nature, a man who, for example, is horrified when he comes to the few occasions here and there, but they exist, of human sacrifice in early Roman history. He's horrified at that, as he should have been. He's got sympathy with the human condition. He's a man who's been trained in rhetoric and grammar and so on, so he knows the humanitarian tradition of Rome. He's a person you would, I think, enjoy talking to, but his influence is still absolutely dominant in the early history of the Roman Republic.
That's Professor Ronald Ridley, Honorary in Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in iTunes and your other friendly neighbourhood podcatching services. Please leave a review, we appreciate the appreciation, and tell your friends about the podcast. You can like the Emperors of Rome podcast on Facebook, and you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at NightlightGuy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we dip our toes into the shallow end of the pool of emperors and begin to explore who came after Commodus, starting with Pertinax. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.